There we go. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Author Talk, the Authors Hall of Fame, Colorado Authors Hall of Fame monthly edition. We love to do around our amazing Hall of Famers that bring their books to life and their themselves to life, so we know more about them, what they're doing, what their maybe works in progress, and all the like. So with us this month, we have the amazing, awesome Helen Thorpe. And I loved it, Helen, when you contacted me when you were invited to become part of the inductees for the first, back in 2019, Authors Hall of Fame, and how you loved the idea you shared that there was some kind of acknowledgement going on for authors out here that just really didn't exist exclusively for authors. So I always appreciated that. When you reached out to me. So with
Absolutely.
that, yeah, with that said, well, everyone, just to remind you who Helen Thorpe is. She is a journalist. She has written three nonfiction books. Her first one was Just Like Us, and it tells the story of two undocumented students who are coming of age and discovering just how hard their lives will be when they compare themselves to their documents friends. Her second, Soldier Girls, which got huge recognition, explored the circumstances of three women who enlisted before 9/11 and then unexpectedly deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. And then her most recent book, unless Helen, you've got another one I don't know about, is The Newcomers, which is a story of comes back to the refugees and immigrants of 22 students during their first year in America and the English language acquisition teacher who taught them English. So with that said, Helen, have you always your journalistic background, has it always covered the life of the immigrant or the student?
No, although I immigrated with my family when I was only 1 year old to the US in 1966. So my dad grew up on the north side of Dublin, and my mom grew up in a little dairy farm in rural Ireland. So both of my parents are Irish immigrants to the US, and they brought me here with them when I was just a toddler, 1 year old, one and change. So I grew up carrying a green card in the United States, and therefore I think had a lifelong interest in immigrant stories. I grew up primarily in New Jersey, K through 12 anyway, and but in the summer, about every other year, my parents would be able to afford to bring us back to Ireland. And we would start off in Dublin with my dad's family. I remember being like age 7, 8, 9, 10, and being handed sort of like a pocket full of change, which would get us onto and off of a bus, onto a bus and onto a bus back home. So we would start off in Dublin. We would stay with my dad's sister. My brother and sister and I would be dispatched onto like one of the double-decker buses at a very young age to ride around by ourselves. We would, go with cousins initially who would show us the way, and then we knew the way, and we would head into city center and come back out. And then we'd hop in the rental car with our parents and head to the farm where my mom grew up, and again, like, be dispatched with little cousins running around, bringing in cows to be milked and so forth. So that's how I spent my summers growing up. And I think that upbringing affected me really deeply. All my aunts and uncles and grandparents live in Ireland or countries close to Ireland, mostly in Ireland. Only my nuclear family is here. And I grew up sort of going back and forth. So when I went to college, I studied English literature, then I became a journalist. I worked at the Atlantic Monthly as an unpaid intern, the Boston Phoenix as an unpaid intern. I got a staff job at the New York Observer. Later, I wrote Talk of the Town stories for the New Yorker magazine. Then I was on staff with Texas Monthly. So I had a robust journalism career. For the most part, I wrote about what my editors, assigned to me, which were not, generally speaking, stories about immigrants. But I remember when I was at Texas Monthly, this is 10 years into a journalism career, the editor-in-chief of the magazine assigned me a story to write about what he thought was a terror cell in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I went to this mosque and I met with the imam and I wore a headscarf and I went to services and I met with women who attended the mosque. And I was like, well, there might be a terror cell here, but most people are just coming for worship. So I kind of turned the story, I flipped the story upside down, and I wrote about how there were many, many, many Muslim immigrants to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and some of them were being accused of crimes. But as soon as that happened, everybody in the Muslim social scene was being suspected, when, in fact, most of them were just there to work or start families and were not in any way trying to harm anybody else. So that was the first time that I actually relied on my own immigrant heritage to write a story about other migrants to the US. And I think that I did have a different perspective than my editor-in-chief. Because I had been born in a different country and my parents had been born in a different country. So I didn't immediately suspect immigrants of nefarious behavior. I kind of thought, well, maybe they're wonderful people who are being, judged inappropriately.
So you,
Go ahead.
I was going to ask you. So you have this strong journalistic background. Did you start writing before you were actually doing internships? Were you, did you
I
write as a
started writing when
child?
I was 7, and a friend of my parents had given me a old typewriter as a gift, and I began typing up poems. And the poems were wonderful by my parents' estimation. I don't know that they were actually so good, but I got a lot of attention for writing poetry at a really young age. And so ever since that age, I've enrolled myself in creative writing classes throughout high school, throughout college. I wrote a creative thesis when I was at college, so a collection of original poetry. And journalism was something I stumbled into, just like trying to figure out, like, how do you make a living at this anyway? So I was, mailing off poems to poetry journals and not getting published and working as a waitress. And so then I stumbled into journalism in search of a paycheck. I immediately fell in love with the way that journalism offers you a front row seat on life and a window onto the world. I remember as like not even a cub reporter, an assistant to the newsroom working at the New York Observer, being told by the other reporters to go all over New York City, all 5 boroughs, to courts and any type of government entity where I might turn up information, or to specialty libraries, like all kinds of places to do research for other reporters, and just thinking, wow, this is the life. Like, this is amazing. I'm learning all about how the world works, and I had no clue before, and I'm finding out about divorce and marriage and death and how the press covers elected officials. So it was right away very, very fascinating to me, the world of journalism. And back then, I'm 60, so back then I was in my 20s 40 years ago. You could get a paying job in journalism without too much difficulty compared to today. And so, I was very fortunate to start off when you could get paid to do this kind of work. So I did those unpaid internships in Boston, and then in New York, had a staff job at the New York Observer, was hired to write talk of the town stories for the New Yorker, did that for a year. I wrote feature stories for Texas Monthly. I moved to Austin, Texas to do that. I became really fascinated by the border. I think, again, that was probably my immigrant heritage. Super interested in like the two cultures meeting. When I had grown up, the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland were two separate countries with a hard border, meaning a militarized border, men with machine guns and uniforms. And we would cross over that border visiting family or spending summers with family in their like caravans in Donegal, which is technically part of Southern Ireland, but typically to drive there, you go through Northern Ireland. So you go into Northern Ireland and out of Northern Ireland to get there. So I was used to crossing borders just with my family and just through our own travel to see relatives and spend time together in Ireland. So the border between Texas and the states of Mexico, the border Texas, really fascinated me. I spent time in Matamoros and Nuevo Laredo and Ciudad Juarez while I was a reporter in Texas. I worked on stories concerning figures who were along the border, like a sheriff in Stark County who'd been accused of corruption by the FBI was investigating him to see if he was guilty of corruption. I wrote a story about him and other stories along the border. So when I moved to Colorado in my late 30s, thanks to a relationship and starting a family here, when I looked around me and I asked myself, like, how is my own community changing? The migration here, which was at a very high level in those days, caught my attention right away. I'm white. My family arrived speaking English. We had documents. And at the same time, when I met undocumented students from Mexican American families, I did identify with them strongly because typically they were the oldest in their family. They had been born somewhere else and their family had come here. And that was, my story. My parents had me in England. Then we moved here. My brother and sister were born here. So, like, technically, we had a mixed status family. So their families made sense to me. I don't pretend that I could understand everything that they lived through. I don't have brown skin. I have not been discriminated against for racial or ethnic reasons. I didn't grow up speaking a different language than English. So there was a lot that I had to learn, but I did feel right away, oh, well, I can imagine being brought here without documents. I mean, my parents brought me with a green card, but I didn't have anything to do with that. I didn't apply for the green card. Somebody just handed me that, So it was very intriguing to me that the situation of undocumented students. I could both relate, and also I knew my story was different, and so therefore I was very curious about the predicament that they found themselves in.
So when you started digging in to the undocumented and your story started unfolding with the different ones, was there a, because you were white and they were brown skinned, was there a trust issue at all? Did they hold you off as you started to have your investigative reporter journalism hat on?
I think there's always a trust issue between a journalist and the people that you're trying to get to know. And I had trust issues with my second book when I was a civilian reporting on the lives of people who served in the National Guard and had been deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan when I had no military experience. There was a trust issue there. And when I worked on my third book, and I was inside South High School, and I was reporting on refugee families. There was a trust issue there. With the first book, yes. I think that trust issue was mitigated right away in the very first meeting I had with the students who ended up becoming the main subjects of the book, when I told them that my family had immigrated and that my mom had grown up on a small family farm. A lot of their families in Mexico had small family farms. So we had a kind of commonality. I think they viewed me as a white person who probably had just a little bit more in common with them than the average American citizen. So my family had immigrated. We had sort of similar rural backgrounds. And I understood that the privileges that I had, were created before I was born or when I was very young. So I reported on those students for a total of 6 years. And I think over the 6 years, our relationships deepened. So I don't think at the outset that they trusted me completely, but I think over time that trust evolved.
So, do you? I don't know which book to jump to, but that your newcomers has got 22 people involved in it. Is that correct? Do I remember that right? Are the
Pretty much. I mean, there were a
subjects
lot of
okay?
students who came into and out of that classroom, but basically, 22 kids stayed in that room for the majority of the year.
Right, and then so, and then the two women who are featured who were in the National Guard, and then they went to Afghanistan.
Yeah, there were three women in that book who deployed to Afghanistan, and then two of them went to Iraq as well.
They did. So, what was there any similarity between these two groups that you saw that bubbled up right away or were revealed as you worked on them?
Well, I think for me, the trajectory involved writing first about Mexican American families and undocumented students, and this question of what is our immigration policy in the United States? Is it serving us well? Who's working here? Do they have children? How are we going to treat those children? All those questions interested me deeply. Then I did feel reluctant after having written about Latino families to again cross over a racial or ethnic barrier. So I deliberately chose to write about women serving in the National Guard because they were white women, in the case of the people that I was interviewing. And I wanted to sort of stay within my own ethnicity with book two. And I learned a lot about conflict, in the process of reporting on their two deployments. With book three, I was fascinated by the fact that we have more refugees than ever, in US history and, or, in global history, being displaced. And I really wanted to dig into why is this happening? Who are these families? What are the obstacles? How do they resettle? And a principal at South High School invited me to spend a year inside that school. Hadn't occurred to me to ask. Journalists are not typically invited to spend a year inside of a school. So this was a really rare opportunity. And I thought, okay, I will again try to cross over these racial and ethnic lines. But this time I'm going to put myself in the book even more. So I did have a first person narrator in my first book when I was writing about Latino families. So I was identifying as white and privileged and married to an elected official, so the reader could judge my observations, knowing a little bit about me. And again, when I was writing about these refugee families, I put myself in the book as a white woman of European descent. And I think including yourself in the narrative is one way to clue the reader in, like, okay, take what I have to say with a grain of salt. Here's who I am. Judge my observations as you will. I'm writing about people whose backgrounds are really different than mine. And that's actually a way of building trust with the reader, to acknowledge where you're coming from and what your perspective is.
So on the immigration issue, I know we have several people with us tonight that I suspect they probably have questions about immigration too. So what is your what was that who, what, why? The variables, the differences that maybe you saw from the Latino in your first book's representation versus all kinds of representation in the newcomers with these 22 students?
So in the newcomers, I was inside a classroom at South High School, which serves the majority of refugee teenagers in the Denver public school system, although there's other schools that serve those families as well. And the students, as far as I'm aware, everybody had legal status in that room. So one big difference is if you're a refugee, you arrive after your family has been vetted by the US State Department. You arrive with a visa and a path to citizenship. So the families I was writing about and the newcomers were not facing undocumented status or illegal immigration or those quandaries. Rather, they had survived traumatic experiences in their home countries in war or extensive conflict between ethnic groups. And it was not safe for them to return to their home country. So they couldn't go home and they didn't know where else to go. So they applied for asylum or had refugee status granted to them by the United Nations. And then they wound up in this classroom. So the classroom is a mixture of students seeking asylum from Central America and students with refugee status from parts of Africa, parts of Asia, and parts of the Middle East. So it was a different, and Donald Trump was running for president and won during the time they spent at South High School. So the backdrop in the United States was becoming from friendly to distinctly unfriendly toward them.
Did that so friendly to unfriendly from students or from people in general on the outside or what?
Friendly to unfriendly from the president of the United States, who was running for president and who won.
Right. So did they felt being personally attacked by him, targeted by him?
Well, after Trump won in 2016, so I was in that classroom starting in 2015. When Trump won in the fall of 2016, there were physical attacks on students from South High School perpetrated by like residents of Denver on city RTD buses. And yes, they were physically unsafe and psychologically probably felt unsafe.
Have you had any follow-up interaction with any of these students many years later now? I mean, we've got 10 years past.
I stay in touch with people from each of the books. So I'm in touch with the women from Just Like Us. All of them have some form of legal status at this point. I'm in touch with the women from Soldier Girls. And I'm in touch with the students from the newcomers.
Do they
So.
have any fear of with the especially the environment today that things could be reversed on them in any way?
Yes.
And as it from your experience, are you giving them or do you give them any input of what they might do or any guidance or do they tell you what they might do? If ICE comes from for them.
That's not the kind of relationship that we have. I don't think I guide them. I think I listen to them. I think, I work with different nonprofits, either as a board member or as a donor or just as an interested person, where I direct, that part of my engagement. But as a journalist, I don't think I try to confuse the relationship that I have with young
With
people
them.
or people I write about
Helen,
without
with your
guiding at
experience,
all.
with your experience of what you've seen over the these many years now, Do you have any thoughts about what could be done that might make things better, smoother, more organized?
Are you talking about US immigration policy?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, my interest in writing about families who live here without without documents, or families who arrive with refugee status or seeking asylum, my interest is really to humanize their stories in an era where we're living through really xenophobic thinking. I don't think xenophobia is particularly helpful. It can get you elected, but it's not going to help you be a great leader. I think that in terms of US immigration policy, I agree that there's been a great failure at our border. I'm not an open borders person. I've never advocated for open borders. So, I think if I were to talk about US immigration policy, my personal views align pretty strongly with the center. So, the reformation of US immigration policy that was proposed by the US Senate while Biden was president was wildly appealing to me. I thought we needed those changes. Unfortunately, Donald Trump decided to interfere and they didn't happen. That's too bad. Maybe that answers your question.
Do you think there's any chance of them being resurrected in any form right now?
No.
I will probably say the consensus of people who are on with us today will agree with you on that. We're kind of all in that central spot on
Yeah.
that. So, are you what in your interviews you did and working with the all ages, all nationalities, what were the surprises that came along?
With the newcomers book or
Well, and any of them, really. For the new, what were the ahas that would drop in that I didn't know this, I didn't get this, I didn't know what they were truly experiencing, or this is a twist, anything like that.
well, I guess to speak about each book sequentially with book one, I think that when you are born a US citizen or arrive here with a green card, as I did, that it's very, very, very hard to understand what undocumented status is. There's very little discussion, very little real discussion of what is that experience like, in our public sphere. We have a lot of conversation about undocumented families, but very little understanding of what is their life like, why are they here, how do they work without legal status, what happens if they're pulled over at a traffic stop. So I was trying to dig into all of that. So the whole time that I spent with those families was to me surprising and revelatory. And I felt their stories were richer than any I'd ever reported on at any point in my life before. One of the major surprises to me was that young people would experience undocumented status as their own fault, or like a lack on their part, when it was really something that was created by the laws in our country and the actions of their parents. They had done nothing wrong. These young people, they had been brought here at age 3 or age 5 or age 7. And yet, as a teenager, you experience undocumented status as if, it's like a deformity or a psychological flaw that you have, or a like you wind up feeling responsible for it in a way when you're not really. And that's just what it's like to be a teenager, growing up. You feel responsible for your family's socioeconomic status, even though you're not a working member of the family. You feel responsible for your racial identity, even though that's something that you just inherited by virtue of color of your skin. So in that way, I think undocumented status weighs extremely heavily on young people, which explains why undocumented students have a very high suicide rate, etc. So I think the extent to which it's a very difficult psychological experience was really revelatory for me because I didn't grow up that way. I had such a privileged background by comparison.
Was that a factor, you think, because you were white?
I think it's because I had a green card
You had
and
the
legal
green card.
status, and because I was white and arrived speaking English and looking like the majority of people in this country. With book two, I think honestly, the gulf between being a civilian or serving in the military was greater than any other difference I've ever tried to cross. So the difference between my background and Latino families, or my background as a documented person and undocumented families, or my background in refugee families, pales in comparison to me being a civilian, and what it's like to serve in the military. I found that the hardest gulf, social gulf, to cross over, and that was probably as revelatory as any reporting I've ever done. I think that the women who that I reported on who served in Afghanistan and then Iraq lived through things that were, really like almost beyond my comprehension. So I was honored that they would share their stories with me to the extent that they did. And then the third book was really like I saw it as kind of like the merger of the previous two books. So writing about refugee families, it was writing about migration and conflict at the same time. So these families had lived through war and migrated then as a result. So it was like a blending of what I had reported on previously. And in that case, in the newcomer classroom itself, I got to learn about what it was like to grow up in the Democratic Republic of Congo, what it was like to grow up in Iraq and Syria, lived through the Syrian Civil War, what it was like to grow up in Myanmar and be persecuted and live inside a refugee camp in Thailand. So that was a very, like, in terms of me trying to cross over a lot of differences or expand my own understanding, that was probably the biggest reach of all.
Where did it come from? This is me thinking out loud here. Where did it come from that immigrants are a burden? What's behind all that? I mean, my own experience with immigrants has been very positive, but what's behind, is that almost like a national belief, or maybe I'm talking about some of the media that's out there, that immigrants are a burden?
I'm not really sure I can answer that question. I've never felt that way myself. I don't think I've been a burden to this country. I don't think my parents have been a burden to this country. My dad was recruited by an American company to work on things including the Apollo missions, and he designed a device that would reduce the visual noise that space radiation creates so that visual images could be beamed from the moon to Earth. I don't think that represents being a burden to the United States, so
Well, no,
I
I
don't.
don't, but I'm talking, I think maybe I might be le leading more towards the chatter out there that people are in here, the immigrants, whether they're legal or illegal, don't really contribute. I mean, clearly what you're saying, your father did this, you've done that. But there is talk that they don't pay taxes. My knowledge is they pay a lot of taxes
Well,
on it.
let me not leave my mom out of the story. So my
Okay.
mom, after growing up in a family of 10 kids originally, in rural Ireland on a small dairy farm, she left at age 17, went by herself to London, where she enrolled in nursing school, became a nurse, met my dad there, came here, recertified, did her training all over again. And worked as a school nurse, ran a facility for handicapped children, became a hospice nurse, and has helped innumerable people. She's beloved by everybody who knows her. That's what an immigrant is to me. The idea of somebody like that being a burden makes no sense to me whatsoever. So I understand there's chatter about it. I just don't get it.
Well,
Doesn't compute.
that sounds like the words that come out of my mouth all the time when I hear this stuff. I don't get it. Why aren't they finding out what's really going on? So, is there a, in your opinion, Helen, is there some twists or takes that maybe should be pushed by not only ourselves, but whether the media, if you can get through to it, or teachers and the like, about what maybe changes need to be put out concerning refugees and anyone who's resettling in the country, so they're not ignorant. And I'm not referring to refugees being ignorant. I'm talking about people who have some of these preformed opinions.
Look, it makes sense to me that Americans would feel uncomfortable if people are pouring across the border in large numbers without documents, and we don't have a sane, sensible immigration policy and a way to deal with that. So I understand why the last election went the way that it did. And why people feel that our immigration system is broken. I think it is broken. I do believe that elected officials in Congress, including our two senators from the state of Colorado, worked really hard to try to create solutions that unfortunately were not passed. I think that until the border feels under control, people in this country will have inflamed feelings and opinions and thoughts about migrants. I think, the incredible socioeconomic collapse that happened in Venezuela that sent so many Venezuelans walking here, had I been a person who lived in Venezuela, I would have been walking here. So I can easily identify with the people who walked here, but having so many people enter our country without legal permission, step into a broken asylum system, it doesn't make a lot of sense the way that we're handling things. I think a lot of things need to be addressed on that front. This country is going to continue to elect zany, xenophobic populists like Donald Trump, who is a terrible leader, as long as we have a broken immigration system. Populists can run on bad-mouthing immigrants till kingdom come and get themselves elected, unfortunately. So I agree with probably the majority of voters in this country that until we feel that our borders are under control, we're probably not going to settle down and feel more secure and have more normal federal elections. So I understand why the last election happened the way that it did. I think it's sad. I think we're all going to bear the consequences.
Helen, you got muted.
I didn't mute myself, but that
There.
kind of stuff happens.
Oh, it's the gremlins, Helen. It's the gremlins that are out there. Right. So, I guess what I want to ask you is what you started with your own background. I see that as a seed. Are there any other authors who have influenced you in the writings? If you went about doing your research, as you put together your stories, even your interview style?
Well, if you could see my bookshelf to the
Okay.
right, I don't think I can necessarily turn this all the way. There, you can see it.
Yeah.
See that bookshelf? They influenced me. So in my house, I am a library school dropout. There's fiction in the living room and dining room. There's poetry upstairs. Over here's the nonfiction. And, if I look over there, I see E.B. White, pretty much everything he ever wrote. Lots of other New Yorker writers from Alec Wilkinson, A.J. Liebling, Joseph Mitchell, Janet Flanner. There's so, oh my God, Ian Frazier, Susan Orlean. I mean, I could go on and on. Over here's a stack of people that I've been teaching recently. Carla Cornejo Villavicencio, the Undocumented Americans. She's an incredible young journalist. Ta-Nehisi Coates. I don't probably need to explain him to anybody else. James Baldwin. This book is really an amazing book. Noe Alvarez, Spirit Run. I mean, I could unpack each of these books. The Yellow House by Sarah Broom, right here. Sarah Broom, African American journalist who wrote for Time, O Magazine, many newspapers in Texas. She wrote a book about her family and their experiences in Hurricane Katrina. So she comes from a large family. All of her siblings, her grandmother, her mother, they were all in different places in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina struck. It's an amazing book about both climate change, but also like our government responses and failures. Noe Alvarez, Spirit Run. This book is just an amazing book about what it means to grow up Latino and poor. His mother worked inside a fruit packing plant. His dad picked apples in orchards in Washington State, and he got a full ride scholarship. But he dropped out of school to go on a run with indigenous runners, running from Alaska down to Panama Canal and from southern part of South America up to Panama and meeting in the middle. James Baldwin, The Fire Next Time. I mean, some of the most amazing nonfiction writing ever produced in America. Ta-Nehisi Coates, Between the World and Me, same thing. But this woman, let me just say a little bit about her. I sort of feel that at this point in my career, I'm a lot more interested in helping the next Carla Cornejo Villavicencio find her stride than my own career. So I primarily teach and work as a one-on-one coach to first-time authors these days. She is a formerly undocumented person, and her family's Ecuadorian American, and what she has to say about being undocumented, it goes way beyond anything I can do, because she's lived it. So that to me is what's really interesting about journalism today, is seeing new voices emerge and helping that happen. So that's what I'm trying to do these days.
One of our aspiring authors, scholarship recipients, Helen, this year was just one of those people who walked across Central America to get here. She's and her book is a memoir of that walk and coming in and so much of what you talk about. So, and she's been great to work with, and see
How
her
fabulous! I can't wait
expansion.
to read it.
Yeah, Amador, I think I will introduce her to you, because she's really doing well on that. So you have a room for nonfiction, you have a room for fiction, you got a room for poetry.
Yeah.
So where does Helen Thorpe go just to drop out for a while?
Well, this afternoon I was hiking in the foothills. Hiking brings me incredible, release. It's a way to decompress. I love third spaces. I love the Tedder cover. I love bookies. I love West Side Books. I love all of our local independent bookstores. I spend a lot of time in libraries. Denver Botanic Gardens Library, the main library of Denver Public Library, different branch libraries. I spend a fair amount of time on the East Coast with my family or visiting friends from college, friends from Texas where I used to work. I think that maybe one of my main sources of inspiration is just the mind state that I find inside museums. So I spent a lot of time at the Museum of Contemporary Art, at Redline, which is an artist incubator, at the Denver Art Museum, at the Museo de las Americas. I love visiting each of those places. I'm there at least once a month.
That's fabulous. You can do that. So, are there any movies that you love that you fall into that either have the story of the immigrant or just something else?
Inspired by young people these days, I watch primarily South Korean television. So I don't
Whoa.
really, yeah, I got a nod from Deb. She's a fan too.
Carol's doing it too.
Yeah. South Korean, pop stars took over music a while ago, but
They did.
South Korean television is also sort of taking over Netflix. We've got like young kids half my age or younger moving, learning Korean and moving to South Korea because they're so enamored of the culture. What I love about South Korean television, it reminds me of my own childhood where it's very family oriented. You typically have multi generations. You often have grandparents as well as parents and young kids all featured in the same show. And so it's just that multi-generational reality. That's how I was raised. It's how I grew up. And I just love it. I love it. I love elders as well as, fumbling young people trying to find their place in the universe. So that's what I watch. I started with Crash Landing on You. It's like Romeo and Juliet with South Korea and North Korea. So that's where I began, and then I just never stopped.
What, have you been to South Korea?
No, I can't wait to go.
All
Dying
right,
to
so
go.
that's on your bucket list?
Yes.
I always like to ask before we open up and people can ask you questions. I always love to ask the question. You're going to have a dinner party and you can invite up to 8 people. They can be living and you're going to bring them back alive. The deceased, you can bring them back, or they're living. Who would you ask?
Oh my gosh. I would ask for sure Carla Cornejo Villavicencio. I have this
Okay.
handy stack of books. I
Oh, there
teach
you go.
Lighthouse
Just reel them
Readers,
off.
and I teach this class called Outward Facing Memoir, and these are all the books I'm using for my next class. Ta-Nehisi Coates, Sarah Broom, down here at the bottom of the stack. If I could, I would ask Joan Didion and Wallace Stegner and Robin Wall Kimmerer. And well, if we're bringing people back to life, I'll bring back James Baldwin. I've been part of a reading group this last, I don't know, we've been meeting for a couple months. We're meeting for a full year, but we're like halfway through a reading group just reading James Baldwin. He's such a master of the essay. Oh my God, his essays are incredible. But I'd never read his fiction before, and I just read Giovanni's Room. So, where he's writing about the gay experience. I just think he's so incredible, such an incredible author.
So, Helen, of the books maybe in that pile right behind you that we
Yeah.
see that you've shared with us. Do you have a favorite all-time book?
You know, when people ask me my favorite all-time book, I typically say Virginia Woolf, To the
Why?
Lighthouse. And I read her when I was still in college, and I just was so blown away by her depiction of psychological reality. It was so different than fiction I had read before. I mean, that's not what I'm trying to do. I don't write fiction. I'm not capable of doing what she did, but I'm still in awe of what she accomplished.
Nice. All right. Let's first of all, thank you so much
Pleasure.
for your insights. And I'd love to open it up and see if anyone has any questions for you. Carol, any questions?
I wonder, it's nice to meet you, Helen. Thank you
Likewise.
for joining us. I wondered if you have any more books in you that you're either working on or planning or contemplating.
Yes, I'm writing the last chapter of a book
Whoa.
that's pretty much a professional memoir about my writing career, written with young aspiring journalists in mind, trying to encourage them to enter this profession. I think we need them desperately. Sometimes, I don't know, journalists like to problematize. We are all taught to do this, but sometimes people sort of like in journalism are naysayers about their own profession, like, oh, sky is falling. The internet exists. We're all doomed. But I don't think so. I just disagree. I just think that, the First Amendment is such a powerful part of this country, and local news is critically important. So is national news. So we just desperately need young people to jump into this profession. So I'm trying to encourage them in this book, talking about what a great life it is.
Do you think that there's certainly been some challenges this past several months. I remember I subscribed to the Washington Post when Bezos actually took it over, which kind of gave him a free rein, and he brought in the former editor of the Boston Globe in to run it. Marty, I can't remember his last name. Marty was the first name. And so I
Eric.
was all jet. Yes, thank you. So I was all jazzed with what was going on, but now I'm concerned with some of the things that have gotten changed with that now. Do you have any concerns for students like you're encouraging them to go into journalism?
Point I'm trying to make is it's a super interesting life. It's a front row seat on everything that's happening in our society. And you get to participate, you get to call the shots, you get to say what you think. You get to write about people running for office. I have found it to be an incredible life. I understand it's a lot harder to get paid today than it was when I started out, but it's also a lot easier to get published. It was hard to get published when I was young. So today it's easier than ever to get your words in print and harder than ever to get paid for doing so. Sure. We're living through a moment where the press is being attacked by the president like we haven't seen in our lifetimes, where people like Bezos are being, maybe we could call him cowardly. He pulled the endorsement of Kamala Harris when I don't think he should have, and so forth. But I'm still glad that somebody as deep-pocketed as Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post and has been putting money into their newsroom. So I'm not going to slam them too hard. Similarly, I'm glad that somebody like Phil Anschutz has been putting money into the Colorado Springs Gazette. I think people investing in news, that's a good thing.
Did being married at one time to a well-known politician ever create blocks from you at all, from some of the things you wanted to write?
Well, I think it did as much good as anything else. Shortly before I met John Hickenlooper, I had reported on George W. Bush's run for president, his successful run. I had been living in Austin, Texas, and I was reporting on his campaign for George magazine. I was on the campaign airplane. Bush couldn't remember our names, so we all had nicknames. And because I went to the local Quaker meeting, I was Quaker Oats, and anyway. So politics had interested me for a long time. When I first met John, very first time I met him, he let me know he was interested in running for mayor of Denver. And I found that intriguing. I thought it was super interesting after having been a political journalist to support him as he ran for mayor after we married, to see behind the scenes what it was like. I think there's so much that you learn when you actually understand things from the candidate's point of view. So we John got himself elected. We had a son. I stayed home with our kiddo for until it was time for him to go to school, and then I set about looking for work, and I could not get hired in the state of Colorado because any newsroom would find it a conflict of interest to hire me as a journalist if John was mayor of Denver. That made perfect sense to me because I had written about the press. I had been a reporter assigned to cover the media industry earlier in my career. So I understood why that would be true. And I just decided, well, I don't have to work for somebody inside the state of Colorado. I'll just write a book for New York. So it kind of galvanized me. It made me become a book author when that was something I'd always wanted to do, but I hadn't really like summoned the nerve to make it happen, and I did. So I think it was a great thing.
So we need to thank John Hickenlooper
Yes. He
for your
definitely
job.
supported me financially while I was working on these books, which I could not have paid the rent on what I earned. So, yeah, thank him.
We all know that story. We've been there and we've done that. Lived
Yeah.
that. Right, Deb, you have any questions?
Well, I'm just surprised at the current backlash to round up all of your undocumented people and kick them out because they're the ones that keep your country going. I'm thinking agriculture. I'm thinking all the blue collar jobs that white people don't want to do. And I'm just I know in the farming community, I listened to an interview yesterday, and a dairy farmer in Wisconsin said if they take all of his workers, he'll be out of business in 2 days. So I don't think they realize how important these people are to your
Deb,
economy.
I have a quickie question. What you all don't know is Deb is in Canada, and they have one of the largest dairy farms
Well,
there. Yeah, and so there you go. So, are you having any issues
no.
with you're not?
Oh, with immigrants or no. No, not at all. We our labor force is from South Asia, so they're all Hindu. And we make sure that they have their social insurance number so that they're on our books. We don't hire anyone under the table, just for our protection and for theirs.
Great. Sue, any questions? Oh, you're blank.
Hi.
Mic's off.
Yeah.
There you are.
No, I was just kind of wondering about Soldier Girls and how I saw an option for HBO and perhaps some people, and I mean, are you interested in getting that out there? I mean, in terms of for an expansion of your books and all your work out there, is that a goal of yours? I mean,
It probably should be. It's not. I haven't been pursuing it. HBO came and was interested in optioning the book, and we sold them an option. I split that money with the women featured in the book, so we all
got a check from HBO. Probably I should be pushing that somehow. I don't know. I haven't. I've been busy teaching and coaching instead. I do think that immigrant labor has been such an essential part of the American economy, like the Canadian economy, and the Mexican economy, because they rely on immigrants from other countries, in Central and South America. But, to me, what I think about when I look at our situation, I think about Europe. Ireland transformed after joining the European Union. In my parents' lifetime, Ireland had been economically very depressed and in a subservient kind of position, therefore, vis-a-vis England, kind of like the relationship between Mexico and the United States. That's what it was like, Ireland to England. But after Ireland joined the EU, it started taking off. The economy is just totally transformed. And that's happened in my lifetime. So my cousins now are not doing the kind of menial work that maybe their parents did or they might once have had to consider. They're working at tech companies, they're working as translators, they're working at, they've got great high-paying jobs. They can afford to buy their own homes. Ireland's become known as like the Celtic Tiger. That's the name for its robust economy. It's really been incredible. That could happen in Mexico starting tomorrow. And what would need to take place for that to happen would be more open trade, an enhancement of what we used to call NAFTA, now the United States, Mexico, Canada Agreement. It would require lowering tariffs, lowering trade barriers, increasing the capacity for labor to move across borders. Ideally, I think with legal status, with a guest worker program, with the chance to work legally, not a black market economy. I'm not in favor of a black market economy. But I think that when we really just step back and look at our geography and see how interconnected Canada and the United States and Mexico are and always will be with these massive long borders that can never be policed effectively, we will understand that we've got to collaborate as a region. And when we do, we'll be stronger and the Mexican economy will be stronger and fewer people will try to come here by, non-legal or without documents, whatever means. What we need is a system that works, a system that recognizes the geography and the regional aspect of how goods move and how labor moves throughout this region. That's what I think we need.
Sounds like common sense, Helen. And it's really very interesting you brought up Mexico, that their president is really seeming to spark people,
Claudia
inspiring.
Sheinbaum seems
There's
incredible.
huge
I love this
support.
woman. She is great.
Yeah. And they're coming out in masses for, I don't know if any of you are watching, but there are huge, I mean, you're not talking about 1,000 people coming out to support her when she challenges Trump back. It's humongous. It's true. It's humongous. So, all right. Well, thank you all for being with us. Thank you, Helen, for your
Pleasure.
insights and for your work, and for
Thank you
your
for the
work and what
invitation.
you've done. And I do hope HBO picks that baby up
Yeah.
and getting go. I don't know how to trigger. That's probably would be coming from your publisher. They probably still have the rights to represent you, do they not?
Well, it would be me and the West Coast agent, the film agent who
Got it.
sold rights. Yeah.
Oh, let's make a phone call and see if we can get it going.
Deal.
All right, everyone. Have a great night. We'll see you
Thanks.
again when we
Bye-bye.
get our next one set up. All right. Take care.
Good night.
Good night.